Black Doctors Podcast.
Hello, welcome back to the Black Doctors Podcast. I am Steven, your host. This week, we're going to jump back into the episode we started last week. Dr. Gaskin, she's an orthopedic surgeon practicing in California. Really enjoyed hearing her pathway. We're going to talk about the field of orthopedic surgery and the incredible lack of diversity and what's being done to change that in this week's episode. I am probably going to relaunch my YouTube channel. I do have a YouTube channel called Ask an Anesthesiologist. And the goal when I started that was to provide information about anesthesia directly to patients, kind of have it patient-focused and patient-centered. I'm at a weird position with social media, kind of a love-hate situation going on. I don't love having medicine all over my social media. Mostly I use Instagram and then some Twitter. Obviously, I'm part of Med Twitter. But over time, I've fallen less in love with being unable to get away from medicine. And if you look at my Instagram, I think when I started out, I was going to use that as a platform to talk about medicine. And I've diverged from that. I just post my music and other things that I enjoy. But man, when I'm scrolling through Instagram and all I'm seeing is like clinical tips and pearls or medical related humor, it's like, can we get away from medicine? I know it consumes a lot of our life. So I've kind of been posting less about medicine, if anything, I do on the Black Doctors Podcast Instagram page because of the demographic it's targeting and trying to help specific students and learners and people in the process. But if you've noticed, you probably haven't noticed, you probably haven't wondered at all, but my social media is mostly just things that I enjoy. So I'm probably going to start sharing again on YouTube. I have a little bit more free time and a little more experience with video editing and audio editing, obviously. And so I'll be posting more medical related content there. I was at the SMA conference, a lot of questions about why did you become an anesthesiologist and what's a day like and what is it like being a critical care anesthesiologist. So I'll be able to get into those topics with more depth on the YouTube platform. And I'll also try to restart kind of engaging and answering patient focused questions to help people kind of navigate that period of time going to surgery or when they end up in the ICU. Another thing to talk about is something that came out recently in the news. I did a fellowship in clinical medical ethics. I'm actually studying to hopefully become a certified ethics consultant, but obviously very passionate about that. I may continue to share that on social media, but recently, Monday of last week, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services put out a guidance that is going to now require consent for sensitive exams. So those are exams of the breast, pelvis, prostate exam, rectal exam that are performed for educational and training purposes. They're going to require consent for these procedures. This is kind of on a national level. Hospitals must obtain written informed consent from patients before subjecting them to pelvic exams and exams of other sensitive areas, especially if it's going to be performed while the patient is unconscious or anesthetized. If you've been in medicine, a lot of times we have standardized patients that we work with during your second year or before you start your clinical work, and you'll learn the sensitive exams, the rectal exam, the vaginal exam, all those on standardized patients. These are people that I think ours were definitely paid, but they've consented and they allow us to learn how to do these very intimate exams. What as a third year and fourth year medical student as a resident differs greatly depending on the hospital within which you practice. Typically, a lot of us are at these academic medical centers, these ivory palaces, and a lot of the times they're more keen on practicing ethically and respect for individuals. You can get out into the more local hospitals or the for-profit hospitals, some of the big nationally owned hospitals. And it's kind of a crapshoot for how they're going to practice medicine, or they're maybe not as up to date on some of the guidances. One thing that comes to mind is unilaterally reversing DNRs. Like a lot of hospitals, that's just a hospital policy that doesn't follow the guidances put out for over 10 years ago from the American Society of Anesthesiologists, American College of Surgeons, and American Association of Operative Nurses. So I have personally seen, having trained at a large academic center, having been a medical student, having worked in probably 5 or 6 different community hospitals, a variety of practices with regards to who is being consented for these exams and if these exams are being done under anesthesia. My personal experience, when I've been at large academic hospitals, I did not see these exams performed without consent in the operating room. The attending staff, they were all very respectful. I was very surprised when one of my first moonlighting gigs, I was in the Navy, I was in Virginia, and I'm moonlighting. I'm covering 3 or 4 operating rooms with nurse anesthetists. And right after induction, as they're getting the patient ready for whatever hysterectomy or whatever the surgery was, there was 2 or 3 medical students. They all lined up and they started to do these pelvic exams. And that's when I realized, like, whoa, like, I really haven't seen this done in most of the places that I've trained and most places that I've worked. So a lot of people are shaking their heads. They're like, why are they putting this memo out? It shouldn't need to be said, but it absolutely needs to be said, needs to be reiterated, and needs to be a national practice since a lot of local hospitals aren't instituting this. So you probably ask, what did I do in this situation? And in that situation, I am just trying to learn a new hospital system, manage 3 or 4 operating rooms, learn every patient's medical history, and provide safe anesthetic care. So my first thought was, did they consent the patient for these exams? And unless I was present for the consent, I did not know if this had been discussed with the patient or had not been. The other thing to know, a lot of times when you get a ruling like this that comes down from the top that, hey, you need to do these consents, a lot of times hospitals will bundle this. They'll have their lawyers look at the standard consent form and they will bundle this all together. And that leads to the physicians and clinicians at the bedside not necessarily having to go through all the details of this consent. But I put that in air quotes. You still are obligated to provide a thorough informed consent. But the hospital technically is covered because they have down other indicated procedures, or they'll oftentimes add a consent for filming purposes to every consent form. So the patient, by signing it, has, by letter of the law, consented to being filmed or to having these extra exams. But by the spirit of the law and from an ethical lens and perspective, that was not discussed with the patient. Again, for an appropriate informed consent, patients should know all the details of what's going to happen for their medical procedure, who is involved. So if I'm working with, right now I work with student nurse anesthetists and anesthesiologist assistants and medical students, and I'm very transparent when I say this person is, I'm working with them to get them today, we're working in a team. Is it okay if they intubate? This is mostly for medical students. Or I ask, for me, I base it upon what is your role in the healthcare team. If you were an anesthesia resident, a student nurse anesthetist, or an anesthesia assistant student, you are there to provide anesthetic care. You're learning the trade. So my consent for the patient would be more effective. Hey, I'm working with a team. I'm working with an anesthetist and I'm working with a student. I'm working with a resident physician, et cetera. We work together as a team. And I don't typically go more in-depth than that. If I have a person who's shadowing, who's not quite yet entered the health professions training pipeline, maybe they're an undergrad student that's shadowing, then I ask from the beginning, when I first meet the patient, I have this person shadowing, they're pre-med, they're applying to medical school. Is it okay if they join us for this conversation? So I kind of am more protective of the patient's information and more sensitive depending on what that trainee's role is in the healthcare space. For medical students, is it okay if they intubate, kind of a more challenging procedure that, of course, I am supervising them in, but I do make it standard practice to discuss all of these with patients because I honestly have nothing to hide. And if patients refuse, that's okay. That's their prerogative. It is very necessary, very needed that the Health and Human Services put this memo out. Other top healthcare officials have criticized the fact that these exams continue to happen without explicit consent. They did send a letter to teaching hospitals and medical schools last week that said hospitals need to set clear guidelines to ensure providers and trainees performing these examinations first obtain and document informed consent. And where do we go from here? If you're a medical student, so often you're in the OR And next thing you're being told to put gloves on and perform an exam. And it's very tough, very challenging to say no, because obviously there's grades and so many other pressures, external influences. The right thing to do would be to say, did we get consent to perform this procedure? And I think that's a simple, non-confrontational way to go about asking this, asking your resident, did you get consent for us to perform these exams? And the resident could say, yes, we did. Or they could say, no, we didn't. You're right. Maybe we shouldn't perform this. You can always conscientiously object and say, hey, I did not personally perform or obtain consent. Or if you're told that that consent was not obtained, then it is within your right to say, hey, I'd like to abstain. And unfortunately, doing the right thing doesn't always benefit you right there. There may be some repercussions. I was actually watching a Reddit thread about issues people that medical students have had with their residents and their attendings. And medicine does have a history of toxicity, still has a fairly toxic culture. There might be ramifications for refusing. For a resident physician, please, you're probably the one that's obtaining consent. So make sure you discuss this with your patients, discuss that these exams would take place if they permit them. And for attending physicians as well, obviously you want to make sure that you instill this into the culture at your institution. For other people that are peripherally involved, having these conversations with your colleagues, as an anesthesiologist, I'll ask the obstetrician I'm working with, hey, we got consent for this, right? And start setting that expectation that, yes, we do need to obtain consent for these very sensitive exams. Imagine it from the patient's perspective. It's horrible to think that you're going to sleep, you lose control of your body, and then people are just doing all kinds of random stuff to you under the guise of education. Medical education is important, but patient autonomy and respect is more important. I'm looking forward to probably the end of this month. I think there's 5 Mondays. I'll do another episode on a medical ethics topic, something I enjoy. And I'll probably put some more of this stuff up on the YouTube channel. Tune in. I'll put links in the show notes. Now we're going to jump back into the interview we started last week with Dr. Alexis Gaskin, again, orthopedic surgeon, subspecialty trained in joints reconstruction. And we're going to continue the conversation we started last week. Thanks for joining. Well, I have to say the people that I know that are in orthopedic surgery are impressive, but the woman orthopedic surgeons I know, Dr. Linda Suleman, who was a couple years ahead of me at Howard, she had her sights set on ortho and was one of the most determined, dedicated people I knew in medical school. I just looked up to her. Dr. Noelle White, we were residents together at the University of Chicago. She was the only Black woman ortho resident in this sea of big white dudes. And she, like, every day just came to work and just took care of business, knowing you mostly through social media, but nonetheless impressive. It speaks to how you have to be stellar and incredible as a woman, as a minority, double, triple minorities, to get into the field of orthopedic surgery. The numbers are abysmal. The last report I saw were about 15% of orthopedic surgeons in training were women and 7% of orthopedic surgeons practicing were women. I don't know if that is that fairly accurate.
Yep. The last numbers I know that, yep, that is, it's getting better every year. You see the, just fitting the match day posts were just so it, there's more programs and more than just one or none. I mean, there's less programs with none, which is very reassuring. And then this past February, we had our academy meeting in San Francisco and the RJOS, Ruth Jackson Orthopedic Society, which is the one, she was the first female orthopedic surgeon board certified. And so that's the society's name after her. When they first started doing it, it was like a small little room, couple tables. This past year, I can't remember the numbers, but my friend was on the planning committee, but a huge hotel auditorium.
Wow.
Filled with tables and every seat. I mean, it was, they were trying to find a few extra sheets to just slide into the tables because it was filled. And so, and granted, we have a handful of male attendees and support, things like that. But for the most part, that room was over probably 95% women.
Wow.
And so in training and as well as in practice. So the numbers are getting better. And obviously, it's not an overnight thing that will happen. And it does seem like even our academy, and I'm part of the American Academy of Hip and Knee Surgeons, so the total joints branch of our society, there's definitely active pursuit of supporting women to come into our field and trying to dispel all those negative stereotypes and myths. And it almost seems that sometimes it's the non-ortho surgeons that are actually discouraging women. And we're finding that. So having kind of groups and coming together at the academy and different organizations, there's also the Women in Arthroplasty, or we say we, that Linda Solomon's part of, and a handful of us, that we're definitely making a push. And we have a lot of our male colleagues that are very supportive, but it's just, it's time, and also dispelling the myths from the outer community within medicine and also beyond patients. I still get the, oh, I thought you were going to be a guy. All right. I thought you were male. And my staff will, and it's around Dr. Gaskin, and they'll start going on he, and they're like, actually it's she. Dr. Gaskin's a woman. So there's the automatic assumptions, and not that it's not malintent, but you know, just the, you know, assuming that every orthopedic surgeon's a male. So it's getting better, but yeah, those are the numbers.
Yeah. And along your pathway going through residency, through fellowship, and then as a practicing orthopedic surgeon, have you faced any challenges that you felt may have been because you were Black or because you're a woman?
Yeah, definitely. I would say throughout training, some people don't like to have direction from women, either in other specialties. When I've made a plan and called and given a directive, the response or the questioning, or they need the kind of confirmation, more confirmation from the guys or things like that. I've had colleagues tell me that I need to be more appreciative to them. So there's definitely numerous occasions where being a woman, I think more than anything, just because being at Howard, I was shielded from nobody is white, right? I don't want to say everyone's Black, because Howard was multicultural. Like there's people from all over. There's people from that have trained overseas and come in. There's people trained all over America. So there's a various backgrounds, and because of that, and I'm grateful for that, was a shield that I didn't have to deal with for that aspect. But being a woman still was different. I mean, I had, you know, not to dog on anesthesia, but there was an anesthesiologist that would ask me to grab things for them. I won't be specific, but help hold the line, help with intubation, help with doing things. And I just remember coming out of the room and going to the ortho library so frustrated. And I was like telling one of the guys in the year ahead of me about it. And he's like, oh, they've never asked me to do that.
Wow.
They've never asked me. And there's just these kind of underlying kind of tones that you can't specifically say. It's always that, why is this happening? Like, why are you doing this to me and not? And I know you don't do it to my classmates. I was the only girl in my class. I'm like, I know you don't do this to my classmates. And I know you don't do it to Kojo or Terry, the guys you know. And so there's incidences from residency, definitely in fellowship, had colleagues say things that I'm just like, wow. And then even in practice, like I'm still not shielded. Even just recently, I've had a, not ortho, but someone in another specialty, literally just like yelling at me I was just like, hey, can you get this started? And this is the plan. And then literally just said like, well, I don't feel that's appropriate and I'm not going to do it. And then called me multiple times telling me why he wasn't going to do it. And I'm like, okay. So there's times where I know they wouldn't talk to the guys that yell and scream.
Yeah.
It's kind of one of those things that, you know, it's there. Sometimes you're prepared for it. Sometimes it kind of catches you off guard, but you always have to be the professional one. You always have to take the bigger road, right? When, like Michelle Obama says, when they go low, you go high.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're just like, dang, I want to go low too.
how do you navigate those situations?
You have to stay calm, because at the end of the day, you'll be labeled as the crazy woman, mm-hmm. or the crazy Black woman, or the angry Black woman. And you can't feed into that narrative. And even when they've done things, how you react is how you are going to be labeled. Yeah. Right. And so even if it may be warranted, you still have to be very cautious, because you just don't have the leeway like others do to react. So it's always a reminder. I also have my go-to friends that I text or call and be like, okay, how would you deal with this? What's the best way? I'm not the type that reacts immediately. Mm. And sometimes I kind of get annoyed. I get frustrated with myself it's like, dang it, I should have said this or I should have said that. But I never react immediately. I take my time. I think about it. I'll talk about it with somebody else and either send an email and talk to them a couple of days later when I'm more calm and collected, that so that I won't respond in the moment. And so those are kind of ways I navigate it, because in a time where you never know how people are going to change the narrative on you or things like that, you always have to be aware of your own reputation. And so you can't let one person's negativity or just bias ruin what you work so hard for. And so those are kind of like the ways in my mind I kind of process. Like, I'm not going to let him or her like kind of tear me down. Even though inside sometimes I'm sure you can relate. It's like it kind of eats at you, because you're just like, I shouldn't have to go through this. I don't deserve this. I've never treated you with disrespect, yet you are disrespecting me. So there's processing and trying to work through it, and also just trying to have a life outside of work to decompress, to not let it kind of take over. But yeah, those are kind of my go-to methods. But I think number one, just don't react in the moment.
Yeah.
Take a breath. Just gather your thoughts, because you might say something you regret. And I think for me in life, this is not just in work. Like, I really don't want to say something I regret to, whether it's family, friend, or anything that. So I've always been the type that just waits and then process kind of thing, because you can't take back the words that you say. And as tough as people want to act, words are powerful. So. Yeah.
Appreciate you sharing that, especially as folks, we have the excitement of matching into specialties and then the reality of starting these residency programs. And you reminded me that so often you may expect your colleagues in whatever specialty that you're going to feel that adversity, that racism, that sexism from your colleagues. But a lot of times you're right. It's the other specialty. It's the scrub tech in the OR. That's just a visiting moonlighting scrub tech that decides to get crazy. Circulating nurses, like, it's coming from all over the place. And again, how you react is what is remembered. My advice, this is not as politically correct, but basically don't put stuff in writing. Cause I've seen people get burned. Like, you're angry and you text somebody or you send an email, like a non-professional email. Now they have proof.
Receipts.
And then don't have witnesses. If you want to pull somebody to the side and then still be polite, professional, but please be aware of who's seeing what you do, especially as a minority resident physician. People are building cases against you.
It's hard. It's a balance, though, because two is the other side can also one-on-one, right? It's a he said, she said. And they can start building the narrative, and especially when you're new.
Yeah.
And you don't have the reputation, and they do.
Yep.
They will, like, the organization, the program, they will often side with the person that they know. And so I think I agree. Don't respond. And I think, again, react with a text message, email in the moment.
Yeah.
Write it down, reread it, have somebody that you can trust, write it over and discuss the events that happened. But you can also get caught. It can backfire. Absolutely. When you don't have. And so sometimes you do need someone in the room with you, because there's a clear bias, and the person that you're working with or interacting with has more power, has more. So it's hard, right? Like it goes both ways. But if you're going to react, I agree. Don't do it.
No, it's all this on top
of closed doors. Yeah.
On top of providing good patient care, you got to navigate all of this. So,
yeah.
But I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your incredible story, your incredible journey, and just those. I mean, everything you said was absolutely phenomenal. And I learned so much and remembered so much from my pathway as well. Awesome. Well, Dr. Gaskin, let's see, you're on social media. You are on Instagram at Dr_LexiLu. And we'll add that link to the show note. Any other socials that you would want people to have or contact you on?
Oh, I am on Twitter or I review the X. It's Alexis Gaskin, MD, I think.
We'll put that in the show notes too.
Yeah, I'll text it to you.
Perfect. And then mentoring or what resources would you recommend for students interested in orthopedic surgery?
If you're at a program, out to those at the program because they're going to be your biggest sponsors and people rely on their letters, getting to know them or them getting to know you so that they can write a true personal letter, not just a generic. There's different groups. There's the Ruth Jackson Society that actually has now med school branches. And so not every school has it, but if there are women that want to start one, my friend, Dr. Lizzie Lieberman is involved with that. So I can also get her involved and start that. There's the Gladden Society, which is Orthopedic Society, Black Orthopedic Society. So all the big names from Howard and the grandfathers of Howard, like Epps and things like that, where they started. So that is also one. There's Nth Dimensions, like N and then TH. That's led by Dr. Letitia Bradford, started by Dr. Bonnie Mason Simpson, that helps get students from year one, helps them with research projects, mentorship, application process, and then gets them through. And you don't even have to end up being an ortho. There's some students that do it and they're like, you know what, actually, I don't think ortho is for me. And they still direct them and guide them to whatever field they want. They actually have now a branch for dermatology, which, as we both recently saw the ongoings of there. So they have dermatology branch now, and then I think radiology. So they're expanding their field into expanding their mentorship and guidance to multiple areas that now are looking to add to their organization. So women and underrepresented minorities in derm is really, really needed, and even radiology. So those are the three programs that I'm most aware of because I'm friends with a lot of the leadership. So, and get involved. Like they call me and they need something. I'm like, okay, where do you need me? So, I think those three programs are kind of the best set up and organized. But yeah, home programs, reaching out on social media. I've had a few people reach out to me. But then also, we discussed early on, it's a two-way street. So, making sure they understand like this is people's time too, they're giving of it. So, please, respect it. Come with questions, come with, goals, things like that. So we can help navigate that and direct. But also don't sit there and like, oh, well, she never called me. We all have lives. We have families, we have work and everything like that. It's not a personal thing. Some things we get caught up. And so just a gentle reminder, like, hey, like, can we set up a meeting in the next 2 weeks? Right. Like, just like you've done when it's a business, right? Like an organization, like give a heads up so people can plan and schedule. But also be understanding, like we all have things that go on, cases that run late. So just continue an interaction. And if it doesn't work, if you don't gel with the mentor, doesn't gel with you, like there's no harm, no foul. Just keep working. You have mentors in all areas. Like I have, like I said, I have older mentors in hand. I have mentors in joints because I do joints. I have women mentors. And so it's like you don't need, and male mentors, like you don't need the same. The one person is not going to provide you with everything.
Yeah.
So, reach out to a couple, multiple people and take what you can and use it in that way.
Awesome.
Sorry, that was a lot.
Everything you say is golden. So many gems. But Dr. Gaskin, I know you've taken so much time out of your busy schedule. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We're here because representation matters.
thank you for having me. Your podcast has been amazing. It's, you know, it's refreshing to have. So keep it up. Like, we all enjoy it. So keep doing what you're doing.
Awesome. You're welcome anytime.
All right. Take care.
All right. I'm going to stop recording.